Thank you very much for the introduction. So I'm not sure if I can live up to the high standard my daughter sets, but I'll try my best. So so today I will talk about quantum error correction and the quantum gravity. So this will be an overview talk covering several works of mine from the past. Yeah, let's get started. Let me begin with some motivation. So as all of you may know, quantum mechanics and the general relativity are in serious conflict, and their mutual inconsistency can be vividly seen in forms of various conceptual puzzles, such as information loss puzzle, firewall puzzle, and so on. But if you think about these puzzles carefully, then you may notice that these are questions in quantum information theory. For instance, information loss puzzle asks, like, yeah, you have a qubit, and then can you reconstruct its initial state after some quantum processing? So with such an interpretation in mind, I think it's pretty natural that we have seen so many interesting applications of quantum information theory in studies of quantum gravity in the past decade. But then what is quantum error correction? Well, as you may know, qubits decay easily or decohere very easily. Therefore, well, we need to protect them from noises and errors. And the basic idea of quantum error correction is to store qubits into many body degrees of freedom in a non-local way, so that local errors or local measurements cannot reveal or destroy the encoded information. And thanks to this non-local encoding, we can perform a fault-tolerant large-scale quantum computation, even in the presence of noises and errors. But then, yeah, why is quantum error correction? Well, in a nutshell, in quantum gravity, you see situations, many situations where information seems to be hidden into some non-local degree of freedom, like quantum error correcting code. So in today's talk, I will discuss several different conceptual puzzles. And in all these examples, hopefully you will see that the notion of quantum error correction emerges naturally and suggests the potential resolutions of these puzzles. Okay, so let me begin with holographic mapping. So the ADS-CFT correspondence states that quantum gravity supported on a negatively curved space-time is somehow dual to the some quantum mechanical system on the boundary. So that means whatever happening on the bulk of the ADS space-time have quantum mechanical descriptions. But to gain some idea, it's usually convenient to imagine a bunch of qubits sitting on the ADS space, interacting with each other. And then the correspondence just says that the information about these bulk qubits are somehow encoded into boundary qubits, like a hologram. Okay, but this correspondence itself can be studied in a very precise manner by studying the so-called correspondence between bulk and boundary operators. So here, let's ask the following question. Let's imagine like there is some bulk operator, phi, some scalar operator, or some Pauli X operator with a spin and so on. Anyway, so given such an operator, we ask how to write down the corresponding boundary operator. Then one of the central results from the ADS-CFT correspondence is the so-called entanglement wedge reconstruction, which says the following. So if bulk operator phi is contained in a so-called entanglement wedge of boundary region, then that operator can be written on that corresponding boundary subregion. So let's look at some examples. So on the left-hand side, you see that A and its minimal curve contains this phi operator. So we can write down some operator OA strictly supported on A. And on the right-hand side, it's a bit more non-trivial example, A1 and A2. And here, minimal surface connects these intervals like a wormhole, and then phi is in the entanglement wedge. So we should be able to find the expression OA1, OA2 supported on these two intervals. I think it's important to mention that currently no generic recipe of writing down the corresponding boundary operator is known in general, but I think it's fair to say that this is a very well-established result. Namely, there is a proof through some information theory technique. But this result has led to a certain puzzle called a bulk locality puzzle. So it's a simple puzzle, so let me explain. So imagine that we have a bulk operator sitting at the center of the ADS space. Then we split the boundary region into three subsystems, A, B, C. And you notice that the bulk operator is contained in BC's entanglement wedge. So we should be able to write down the corresponding operator on BC. But same applies to AB, AC. This means that the corresponding boundary operator must be supported on AB and BC and CA. But non-trivial operators, there is no such operator simultaneously supported on these subsystems. This seems to imply that the bulk operator is actually just trivial identity operator. But if that's the case, then this correspondence seems a bit boring. And the notion of quantum error correction suggests a potential resolution of this puzzle. That is, so what was wrong in my argument? Well, I implicitly assume that there exists a unique and single corresponding boundary operator, right? But maybe that was wrong. But more specifically, maybe there exist three different operators, OBC, OAB, OCA. They are different, but they act in the same manner in some low energy subspace, which may be viewed as a code word subspace of a quantum error correcting code. It's actually this holographic mapping is exactly how a quantum error correcting code works. So imagine that a piece of quantum information is encoded on the bulk through bulk to these three subsystems, ABC. Then imagine, like, by some accident, you lost access to all the degree of freedom on A. Yep. Then still, bulk point is inside the entanglement wedge of BC, so you should still be able to reconstruct the original quantum information. So in this sense, this realizes a quantum error correcting code, which protects the information from erasure of one subsystem out of three. Now, this observation motivated me to construct a toy model of the ADS CFT correspondence. So this time, let's imagine that in our universe, we only have one bulk qubit and five boundary qubits. So there are only six qubits in your universe. Then by carefully examining what the entanglement wedge reconstruction would tell us, then we notice the following. Any region with three qubits, like ABC, ABD, contains this bulk point. Therefore, we should be able to find the corresponding expression of operator on any three qubit regions. That is the property this toy model should have. But luckily enough, we have such a code that is called five qubit code. The basic idea is we have, as an input, we have a single qubit state, but we encode it into five qubit entangled state. And I'm not going to write it down explicitly. It's a bit complicated expression, but what is important for us is that indeed this realizes the entanglement wedge reconstruction. And as an example, I wrote down how Pauli X operator acting on the bulk qubit can be mapped to three-body Pauli operator on the boundary. So in this sense, this simple toy model is indeed like a ADS-CFT correspondence, although there are only six qubits. Now, but this is of course too small. Now, in order to make it even bigger, we can use a technique of tensor network. Roughly speaking, the idea is we prepare a bunch of five-qubit code, represent them as tensors, and then glue them together to form a bigger network. In this case, you will see that there are dangling bulk, open, tensor X, And these can be viewed as bulk qubits, bulk degree of freedom. And then those on the boundary, these are boundary qubits. And then this entire thing defines the encoding map from the bulk to the boundary. Now, I think I should say a bit more about its physical interpretations. So it's essentially qubits on the bulk represent like matter degree of freedom that is sitting on the fixed geometry. And then, but these matter fields are sort of coupled to the geometry by these 5-qubit quota tensors. So in this interpretation, changing the bulk state locally is like creating excitation on the bulk, which, by the way, is seen from the boundary. It's like a delocalized effect here, showing in this red colored dots. Now here, I think it's very important to keep in mind that the bulk Hilbert space is much smaller than the boundary Hilbert space. That's how we define the codeword subspace. And this is because this model is designed to capture perturbations around some fixed geometry. So it's very important that. Yes.
Could you just go back two slides?
How many slides? Yeah, two.
Just two. Just one. This toy model. One, maybe one more, please. Yeah. Can you just explain precisely what this slide is? I feel like this slide is important, and if I don't understand it, I will be lost. So there, is this an equal sign, this arrow, and the bulk operator in the middle, is it connected to the five outside or not? Could you just please explain this slide a little bit slower?
Yes, yes. So initial state is alpha 0 plus beta 1. And then we can apply Pauli X operator. And then that will change the encoded states accordingly. So changing the input by applying Pauli X is same as applying these 3-qubit Pauli operator on the output state. That's what it means. So you can implement Pauli X by these 10 different expressions of Pauli operators. And then they do act in the same manner in this subspace of this code.
And again, the question is that the gray means you can do whatever you want there? What you
gray means identity operator. We don't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Just to make sure I understand. So there are this tensor in the middle, it's connected to the other ones, right? So here you did not draw those connections on the right?
Tensors.
This bulk point is connected to the boundary point, right?
So this bulk point represents the input qubit in a sense that you can imagine like it has some specific state. In this case, alpha 0 plus beta 1 is arbitrary state, can be mixed or pure. Then we think of applying X operator on the input. That changes the output state. We can do the same thing, like changing the input state. So that effect can be done in the same way by applying these 3-body operators on the boundary. That is what it means.
So just to clarify, so I think what you say is that this statement of input output, this is explained on the slide when I interrupted you, right? This you did not explain here, but it's later, right? It's this picture where you act on the bulk and then you have some bulk.
Tensors, right. So you can imagine like this red dot is projected to some particular state that will be your initial state, input state. Then this A, B, C, D, E becomes a 5-qubit quantum state. That is the encoded state.
Sorry, Ben, can you explain again? I'm completely lost. So what type? So you have basically a state that's a superposition, let's say spin up plus spin down with an arbitrary linear combination. Right, 0 or 1. So can you give a physical example of exactly what you did in the previous, what you explained in the previous slide? Because this is way too technical.
Right. So this is just a linear map from the input to output. So input is a single qubit state, alpha 0 plus beta 1. then we are going to map it to alpha C0 plus beta C1. C0 and C1 are orthogonal states on the 5-qubit Hilbert space. This is the mapping we have. And then,
okay, so how do you do the mapping? What does the mapping mean?
Mapping means it's literally mapping in a sense that you can choose any arbitrary pair of C0 and C1, which is orthogonal. And then you can define consistent mapping. And this mapping can be, by the way, done unitarily by preparing four additional qubits and then applying unitary. And this is doable. But here by five
qubits. So you're transforming X to some linear combination. So what does the X, Y, and Z mean? So you just transform, I'm still very lost. You can carry on, but.
I guess maybe what is asking, can you write what is C0 and then how?
Writing down C0, C1 is really.
Maybe just a cartoon of it. And then what does it mean to act with Z on the tensor product? That's all.
So
I'm asking the basic of the details.
So it's just. Yeah, I don't know how to explain. It's just a map defined in this way. So C0 and C1 are orthogonal states. And
it's just that it's a tensor product.
It's not tensor. Well, it's defined on 5-qubit Hilbert space. And
sorry, maybe there is a confusion as well in the notation. So you have X is an in state. What's the relation with the label X on the left with any of the X's that show up here? And what Z and
so,
Y?
So X is a Pauli X operator, Y is a Pauli Y, Z is a Pauli Z operator. My claim is that applying X operator on the input is same as applying, let's say in this example, YYX on the output stage.
So is this a penalty?
So if you're writing something on the board, we cannot see you on Zoom. Sorry. Or if you're showing something on the slide.
So in fact, writing down C0 and C1 is really difficult and explicitly, and we usually don't write it down explicitly. We use some other technique called the stabilizer formalism. But I don't want to go through these. But
what is the takeaway message from this? Because this is very confusing. So you're mapping
takeaway message is that these 10 different operators, they are different operators in the Hilbert space of 5 qubits, right? But they act in the same way in the Hilbert space spanned by this C0 and C1.
There's a very simple way to say this in terms of the representation.
Mm-hmm.
This was done by Fendel.
Well, I'm not sure, but it's just I think what I said is that just they are different operators, but they act in the same manner in the subspace. That's all I say. And in this particular example, we design C0 and C1 nicely. Then you can show that all these operators act in the same manner in this subspace.
Okay, and this is important because, sorry to be so blah, because I'm very confused. This is way too technical.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, and I'm good to go, or?
No, she needs
to the other picture.
You've transformed it to various kinds of boundary output. She just needs to hear that.
Oh, so
yeah.
Well, what should I say?
You don't have to say anything.
Oh, I see. okay. So Pauli X operator defined for 0 and 1 basis in the input. On the right-hand side, you see three-body operators. They can be viewed as a Pauli X operator, but defined in the space of C0 and C1. Yeah.
OK, and I guess the red dots live on the boundary of something, and X lives in the box.
Red dots are the qubits where I apply my operators. Gray dots are those I don't touch. So again, so flipping my input spin by poly x is same as flipping my output spin on these red qubits with this particular choice of poly operators.
I think if you go back one more slide. So there you had a cartoon that what you I shouldn't be doing, but there you have a cartoon of ADS-CFT, right,
yep.
Mina? Do you these pictures are showing stuff in the bulk, in the middle of the circle, and stuff on the boundary. And so,
okay.
So what he's showing you on the next slide is he has a bulk operator, and he's showing that it has various different representations as a boundary operator. Did that help at all?
I mean, kind of. I think my confusion won't be fixed so quickly. But that helps, Rob. Thank you. That helps a bit. But carry on. I don't think my confusion will be fixed here.
Okay.
So do they need to satisfy the same commutation relation or algebra? The bulk operator and the boundary operator.
So x will be mapped to something, z will be mapped to something, and then, yeah, they should. At least in this construction, yes. That is because I can define the commutator, like x and z commutator, as my operator on the bulk, and then that should be mapped to the boundary as well.
Why is it important that the bulk operator is mapped to many operators on the boundary?
Why is it important for a logical operator to be defined on many qubits? In a sense that this is a code with a large distance, or it's just we can give more like interpretation, but this is what the entanglement wedge reconstruction predicts, and yeah. Then there should be three operators. If it's two, then yeah, this is not possible. Yeah.
Sorry, Benny, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
So this was relatively easy to do because the Hilbert space in the bulk was very small, right?
Yes,
and then in the boundary, you had a huge Hilbert space, so it was easy to fit many sigma x's from different points of view in the boundary, right?
Yeah. This is.
So my naive question is this what we expect? Do we expect the Hilbert space to be bigger? Don't we expect the Hilbert space to be of the same dimension?
You mean in ADS-CFT correspondence, or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. So this is the simplest or probably the smallest toy model of the ADS-CFT correspondence, and then one way to make it bigger is to use a tensor network, and then yeah, we have a bunch of qubits on the bulk, and yeah. But we can.
My confusion is not about small tensors versus many tensors. My confusion is about the dimension of the Hilbert space in the bulk versus the dimension of the Hilbert space in the boundary.
Oh, I see.
It's the same space, so it should have the same then.
Right.
It should not be smaller than the other.
I think confusion people had, like, bulk is higher dimension. It looks like its volume is bigger than the boundary. But I think this is very important because we are defining a code word subspace. So in order to define the subspace, the bulk degree of freedom must be smaller than the boundary degrees of freedom. And the one way of understanding this is like a bulk. If you believe holography in a sense, like, yeah, holography, then boundary quantum mechanics should contain everything. Then the bulk, if we look at bulk, we have two things, bulk quantum states and also geometry itself, right? So then here, what we are talking about here, bulk Hilbert space, and also there is something we don't talk about, that is geometry itself, but that geometry itself picks the subspace. So if you change the subspace, you go to different subspace. So you can put quote-unquote black hole by changing the geometry, but that gives you a different code about subspace in there. Yeah.
No, sorry, I'm still a bit confused. Sorry. And if the chair thinks I'm asking too many questions, please tell me to shut up. But my confusion is, normally we expect one state to be represented either in the bulk or in the boundary, right? The Hilbert space is the same. There is, for each state in the Hilbert space, there is one, you can represent it in the bulk or in the boundary.
Yeah.
But it looks to me, but maybe I'm wrong, that in your example, in the bulk, you had spin up or down. So it was a very simple Hilbert space. But in the boundary, you had up or down five times. So it was much bigger. So I'm probably missing something basic. But the Hilbert, you could do many more things on the boundary than on the bulk. You
yes,
have many more
yes,
states
yes,
on the boundary.
Yes,
than on
that's
the
right.
Bulk.
That's right. That's
not what we expect, right?
No, that is what we expect, because here we are talking about perturbative theory on a fixed background, right? So that's not everything we can represent in the ADS-CFT correspondence. You can change the temperature, and then you can create a black hole there, and so on. Then you have a different geometry. Then there you are utilizing different subspace. So eventually you can utilize all the subspaces, but here I'm focusing on one particular geometry, then that automatically picks me some subspace. So yeah, this one qubit and five qubit is extreme, but I think this picture is much better in the sense that you have, so in this language, essentially going outside this Codeval subspace is like changing the geometry of the bulk. And then to change the geometry of the bulk, you add more energies on the bulk, and it will back react to the geometry, and it changes the underlying geometry. That's one way of bringing you outside the Codeval subspace. Then by that,
you can I understand the matching of the dimensions if I consider the space of stuff that is light enough not to back react? If I just consider ADS plus particles inside ADS, they are not going to start back reacting on ADS. And it's still quite a huge Hilbert space, and I should be able to see that they are in one to one. Maybe it's related to your excited state description.
Can I? I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt both Lee and Pedro. I think we have to keep moving on. I'm sorry, Pedro, but why don't you keep going, Ben?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say in this slide. Is like, yeah. So this is a subspace. So lower dimensions, and then, yeah, we are studying only perturbation around the fixed background geometries. And if you want to go to other subspace and then Hilbert space, yeah, you can just change the geometry. All right, yeah. And then, this toy model is based on the 5-qubit code, but you can make this toy model even more realistic by using Hall random tensors, for instance. Then this toy model becomes analytically tractable and then reproduces a number of key properties like Ryota-Carnegie formula, entanglement wedge reconstructions, and so on. And I believe that you can make this even more realistic, let's say by considering continuum variables and adding symmetries and so on. But I think one virtue of a toy model is its simplicity. So yeah, I think it's nice to have a solvable toy model. But this type of toy model on negatively curved spacetime or flat tiling actually becomes a useful toy model to actually capture the entanglement growth and operator growth in the many-body physics and so on. And also, these can give us a nice intuition about complex histy growth in the black hole interior, and also, you can get some nice intuition about the page curve calculations and so on. But I guess looking at the future, I think it's probably interesting to use these techniques beyond the ADS-CFT correspondence. And one way of going beyond is to consider spacetime with cutoffs, let's say end of world brains and so on. And another interesting system is, of course, positively curved spacetime. And it turns out that in these systems, actually, you can see that So this tensor network toy model can give us nice intuitions about entanglement structure and resolve some conceptual puzzles associated with these subspace, these spaces. Okay. But anyway, that's a bit of old work, I think, from 2015. But I want to move on to another topic that is holographic scattering, and I'm not sure if how I'm doing in terms of time anymore, but let me just. So the most important lesson we have learned so far in the past decade or so is that ADS-CFT correspondence can be viewed as a quantum error correcting code. And this kind of interpretation further supported the famous slogan that from Qubit, which just say that space-time may be emerging from quantum entanglement. This way of thinking transformed our view of quantum gravity in a fundamental manner. But I think this slogan is not enough, and the reason is that we have seen some evidences showing that interactions in the ADS space-time is also emerging from quantum entanglement. And this viewpoint was, I think, advocated by Alex May in 2019. But in a recent work with Alex and John Source, we have sort of further advanced this viewpoint by incorporating the notion of a quantum error correction. Now, that being said, I already gave a talk on this topic a few months ago, so I will be very brief on this part. Okay, so let's again recall that ADS-CFT correspondence says that whatever happening on the bulk must have boundary quantum mechanical realizations. So here we are going to ask the following question. There are some particles that starting from the boundary of the ADS spacetime, and then they travel to the center of the bulk, and then they may interact and scatter, and then scatter off to the boundary. And then the question is, how do we characterize such a procedure in the boundary quantum mechanics language? Now, from the bulk viewpoint, in principle, we should be able to apply any unitary interaction among these three particles. To be more specific, you can imagine three people, person one, person two, person three, they travel to the center of the bulk and then meet there and then say hi to each other and they interact with each other unitarily and then scatter off to the boundary again. That is, in principle, allowed a physical process. Now the question is, how do we write down such a procedure on the boundary quantum mechanics? Namely, how do we turn on interaction among particles? And it turns out that this simple thought experiment led to a certain important puzzle that was pointed out by Alex May. So on the left-hand side, I have two particles with some particular input and output locations, U1 and C2, R1 and R2. Okay, that's a very normal scattering process. On the right-hand side, I have the boundary space-time, and I have normalized the length and the time nicely so that the light ray propagate at a 45-degree angle. Anyway, so the point here is that on the boundary, it seems like there is actually not enough time for particles to interact with each other. Namely, you can bring C1 and C2 together at the middle point, but then you can't scatter them off to R2, right? So it seems like on the bulk, they are allowed to interact with each other, seemingly, but on the boundary, they are not allowed to interact with each other. So then does that mean all the particle in the ADS-CFT is a free particle, non-interacting? But that's a bit strange. Then the key idea to resolve this issue is to notice that these two particles, C1 and C2, have access to some quantum entanglement. This quantum entanglement is actually actually available through the geometry itself. It is related to the connectedness of the geometry through the Ryota-Carnegie formula. But by utilizing this pre-existing entanglement, the idea is interactions may be indirectly but induced thanks to this pre-existing entanglement. And this is a beautiful suggestion by Alex May. Okay, so with this insight in mind, we can recall that, again, that ADS-CFT correspondence is a quantum error correcting code. Namely, particle at the center of the bulk is like information is encoded into a code word subspace of a quantum error correcting code. With this picture in mind, sending a particle to the center of the bulk is like encoding information into quantum code. Then, by the way, interactions inside the subspace is called logical operations in quantum error correcting code. So we have logical operation there. And finally, we are reading off the encoded information by sending it to the boundary. So that is just decoding. So this scattering process should be happening in three steps: encoding, logical operation, and decoding. Now, one of the central results we had from our paper is that the pre-existing entanglement in the ADS space actually gives us the right kind of entanglement, which allows us to do this non-local encoding. Namely, it's very important to utilize this entanglement because without entanglement, you cannot actually delocalize the quantum information through the whole system. So we really need to use the pre-existing entanglement. By the way, this is this idea is called entanglement-assisted quantum error correction. By using entanglement, you can further delocalize quantum information. Now, the point is that by using this kind of protocol, we are able to show that various kinds of interactions can be induced on these qubits or qubits or spins. Yeah.
Can you send information faster than light using this code?
No. Its causality is all good.
But the first
mm-hmm.
Bridge is the boundary.
Right.
Entirely bypassing motion.
I think it's this right-hand side figure is, I think, a cartoon version of this situation. Then here you see that, let's say, psi 1 is the initial information. Then without utilizing the entanglement, I can delocalize it over M1 and M2, these two points. But I cannot distribute it to M3. But if C1 and M3 shares entanglement, by mixing psi 1 and this thing, then we can actually delocalize quantum information over M1, M2, M3. But that does not allow us to send the quantum information superluminally, because in order to reconstruct the original state, we need to have access to more than one subsystems. So in this context, getting M3 doesn't allow us to reconstruct psi 1. M3 and M2, then we can do that. So since we have access, we need access to M2, so yeah, it's causally okay. So yeah, everything like locality and so on is good. Now, of course, one immediate future problem is to verify these kind of ideas in a concrete model of holographic CFTs, but I'm actually more kind of excited about the similarity with a quantum computer. That is, in a quantum computer, what we do is we encode information and do the computation and then decode it. That's how it works. It looks very similar. So in this sense, maybe we can view the ADS-CFT correspondence as a fault-tolerant quantum computer. And in this context, I believe that putting perturbations on the bulk, let's say putting too much energy on the bulk, creating black hole, will, of course, prevent the scattering event. So maybe these may be interpreted as errors in the quantum computation. So I hope that this kind of intuition may be made more quantitative in the future. Okay, but anyway, the point I wanted to emphasize is that this idea of quantum error correcting code is very useful to understand the emergence of space-time, but it seems like it plays important roles to understand how even like interactions are emerging in ADS-CFT correspondence. And of course, this research program is still just beginning, but I feel it's quite exciting. Okay, now I want to shift the gear a little bit and then talk about different thing that is mostly about quantum information scrambling. So let us just recall the problem. So we throw a quantum state into the black hole, and then whether it is permanently lost or not is, I think, was one of the biggest open problems in theoretical physics. And if you want to study this information loss problem, the one concrete way is actually throw a quantum state into a black hole and ask if it is possible to later reconstruct the initial state of the this input qubit or not. And then here in this talk, I will focus on one particular thought experiment due to Hayden and Preskill, because in a sense, this thought experiment is designed to capture the very moment when information is leaking out from the black hole. So let's imagine that we have the so-called old black hole, which has emitted already more than half of its content. This just means that this black hole is maximally entangled with the early radiation R. And here, I'm going to even simplify this situation by assuming that black hole and early radiation is given by n copies of EPR pairs, where n can be viewed as a Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Okay, then given such an old black hole, Alice throws a secret quantum state into a black hole, and then these A and B will interact with each other, presumably by some unitary dynamics. And then later, Bob tries to reconstruct Alice's quantum state by catching the Hawking radiation. And then the question is, can he do that or not? Okay. But the interesting twist Hayden and Preskill added is that not only this late Hawking radiation that's coming out from the black hole, but Bob actually has access to all the early part of the radiation, because that is already outside the black hole. So then by having access to both late and early Hawking radiation, can Bob reconstruct the initial state or not? That is the question Hayden and Preskill asked. It turns out the answer is yes, but surprisingly, it turns out that Bob just needs to collect a few qubits from the late radiation. By few qubits, I mean that if A's qubit is NA, then NA plus epsilon is fine. And epsilon doesn't depend on the system size. That's what I mean by just a few qubits. So this is a surprising result Hayden and Preskill found in 2007. But this is a great paper, but they didn't resolve two important problems. First of all, they assume that the black hole time evolves by hard random unitary, but actual black hole is probably not time evolving by hard random unitary. Also, they were able to show that it is in principle possible to reconstruct the information, but they were not able to tell us how to do so. So the main goal is to resolve these two issues, but to resolve these issues, we need to recap some key dynamical signature of a quantum black hole that is scrambling. So scrambling, I will probably oversimplify the phenomena of scrambling just to focus on the key issue. But in a nutshell, scrambling is related to the operator growth. So imagine that we have a one-dimensional system of qubits, and then we are going to focus on one particular operator, let's say power x or y or z operator, acting on one particular qubit, this red dot. Then if this Hamiltonian is sufficiently chaotic or interacting and so on, then we expect that its size will be bigger in time, because this WT will become more and more complex operator. And then eventually it becomes like a very, very high weight operator. And it turns out that scrambling just this growth of the operator size. And just to the quantum information theory audience, you can interpret this growth of the operators more nicely by using the so-called Choi isomorphism to map operator to quantum state by doubling the Hilbert space. But anyhow, the point here is that operator size grows. This is something I think everyone knows from undergrad, but this turns out to be this phenomenon of scrambling. But the real question is, how do we detect and why such a growth of the operator plays some crucial role in any of the physics? And then it turns out, in order to characterize the growth of the size of the operator, you should look at something called out-of-time ordered correlation function, OTOCs. This looks like this V0WT. By the way, this expectation value is usually defined with respect to thermal ensemble. So you can imagine a maximally mixed state. Then the point here is that at t equals to 0 at the beginning, if V and W do not overlap with each other, then this weird ordering of operators do not matter at all. But if WT and V starts to overlap, then this matters. And it turns out that this correlator usually decay to small value. And so for this reason, this OTOCs can actually physically capture the size of the operator growth. And then you might think that measuring this quantity requires a time machine. It looks like so, but it's actually there are situations where you don't need a time machine, and then this shows up naturally in actual black hole physics. But I'm not going to go into details of these. But anyway, now back to the black hole physics. You can actually easily compute this OTOCs in a black hole, at least within the ADS-CFT context. And the idea is to just view V or W as a gravitational shockwave, which induces some non-trivial back reaction to the geometry. And then you do the calculations. And then you can easily show that this indeed decays around the so-called scrambling time. This type of calculation was done from both bulk and boundary perspectives. But I think it's important to mention that a similar line of calculation was done in different contexts already in the 80s. Anyway, now having reviewed the notion of scrambling, let's just prove that it's indeed possible to reconstruct the quantum information from a black hole. So here is the Hayden-Preskill thought experiment. All the black hole, which is just EPR pairs, it's very simple, and then diary, and then they are mixed unitarily. And then we are going to catch D and R, that is early and late radiation. Now, here's one little information theory trick I need to explain. That is, I have introduced the so-called reference system, A prime, that is entangled with A. That is, instead of placing one particular state on A, I placed EPR pair between A prime and A. And this A prime effectively keep track of initial state that's prepared on A. The nice thing about this trick is that if the information is recoverable, then A prime and DR must be entangled. And this entanglement between A prime and DR allows us to actually show that, yes, recovery is possible. Now, one nice result is that it turns out that if black hole's dynamics is scrambling in a sense of OTOCs, then you can actually rigorously show that A prime and C, which is the black hole, remaining one, will be decoupled. So they share no entanglement. But because of the monogamy of entanglement, or unitarity of U, you can actually show that it's equivalent to say that A prime must be entangled with D and R. Therefore, you can show that if the dynamics is scrambling, then it is possible to reconstruct the initial state of Alice's diary, thanks to the scrambling dynamics. Now, the remaining task is to construct the recovery protocols. And I believe there are currently two types of concrete recovery protocols. One is due to myself and Kitaev, and the other one is the so-called traversable wormhole geometry. And I'm not going to go into details of these protocols, but their protocols are of course kind of related, but it's actually work in a different time regime. Namely, our protocol actually works both before and after the scrambling time, while the traversable wormhole protocol works before the scrambling time only. But the complexity of implementing this protocol tends to be higher in our protocol, and especially around the scrambling time, it seems like there is a phase transition of the circuit complexity to implement such recovery procedure. That's something interesting to note. And well, we did some experiment, but this is theory audience, so I will just skip. But okay, I have talked about a bunch of entanglement and so on, but where is quantum error correcting code? And it's actually this Hayden-Preskill thought experiment is another realization of the so-called entanglement-assisted quantum error correcting code. That is, even though this unitary transformation, scrambling unitary, mixes only A and B, Alice's initial diary is now delocalized over C, D, and R. And the way to see it is that, of course, A's diary can be reconstructed by seeing C and D, right? But what we have shown so far is that diary can be also reconstructed from D and R, and probably similarly C and R as well. So by having access to two subsystems, one is not enough, but having two is enough to reconstruct the Alice's original quantum state. So in this sense, what we showed so far is that, scrambling, the decay of out-of-time ordered correlation function is sufficient to realize entanglement-assisted quantum error correcting code. And the recovery protocol is just a decoding algorithm of the entanglement-assisted QECCs. Okay. Good. Now I have hopefully more time. And finally, I will talk about the firewall puzzle and the black hole interior. But this part is actually immediate if you follow the previous part. So now let me remind you again of the problem. Once again, we will consider the old black hole, which is maximally entangled, so that the black hole and this early radiation is maximally entangled with each other. Then according to the effective field theory calculation, near the horizon, we will have a constant creation pair of entangled partner modes. That entangled partners we can call D and D tilde. So D is the outgoing Hawking mode, and D tilde is the ingoing mode that are entangled with each other. That is a prediction from the semi-classical calculations. But on the other hand, we have assumed that this is an old black hole, maximally entangled. This would mean that this D degree of freedom must be entangled with the early radiation. Then we should be able to identify and distill the degree of freedom RD, which is entangled with D, right? But then if you think about this situation carefully, this is very strange because D is entangled with the deep line, D tilde, and D is entangled with RD. But we know that one thing cannot be entangled with two things simultaneously. This is called the monogamy of a quantum entanglement. This seems to suggest that because of the D and RD entanglement, D and D tilde are not entangled with each other. Our effective theory is breaking down. Maybe there is a high energy density near the horizon, and therefore firewall. That is the firewall puzzle. Now, one potential approach to resolve this firewall puzzle is the so-called ER equals to EPR proposal. This proposal asserts that, it's actually this interior degree of freedom, black hole's interior d tilde, is embedded in the early radiation. Namely, what it means is that when Alice crosses the horizon, when she actually sees d tilde, it's like what she actually sees is RD in the early radiation. That is the proposal. And this proposal, of course, have an obvious drawback of the non-locality problem. That is, why just suddenly jumping into the black hole, then Alice can see something on the early radiation that is outside the black hole? And you can make this problem more manifest by bringing early radiation to somewhere in a distant universe. Or you can consider a two-sided ADS black hole to make this problem more clear. And there's also a potential problem from the quantum complexity viewpoint, but I'm not going to go into details. And so despite these subtleties issues, ER equals DPR proposal is, I think, very popular in some string theory community. And I think it is important to emphasize that my approach is orthogonal to this proposal. And another important thing to mention is that there is a famous slogan, ER equals to EPR. That is a slogan, which is fine. But this ER equals to EPR proposal and this slogan shouldn't be confused. And namely, by ER equals to EPR proposal, I mean a particular proposal that appeared in that proposed as a potential resolution of the firewall puzzle that appeared in the same paper, which is called ER equals to EPR paper. But anyway, in short, by ER equals EPR approach, these approaches which accept the non-locality. That is the point. Anyhow, that is another proposal. But anyway, so previous proposals actually didn't, previous works usually didn't consider the importance of including infolding observer to the problem very seriously. So the starting point is to actually consider the infolding observer very seriously and include it in the part of the quantum Hilbert space. So again, so I'm gonna simplify the problem by assuming that all the black hole is just the EPR pairs. But this time I'm gonna assume that Alice, an infolding observer, is actual physical object with finite energy or entropy. Okay. So I have black hole, early radiation, and Alice. Then the question is, oh, okay, so I want to mention that again, I'm going to use the reference state trick because instead of keeping track of all the possible physics depending on the initial state of the Alice, it's more convenient to append the reference state and the physics. Now, of course, without an infolding observer, we know that the outgoing mode must be entangled with early radiation. That is what quantum mechanics tells, so we should accept that. But the question is, by including an infolding observer as actual physical object, then where can I find the entangled partner mode of outgoing mode D? That is a question we want to address. And it turns out that because of the addition of the infolding observer, the entanglement structure changes drastically. And again, this decoupling theorem becomes very useful. But this time, it looks like the same theorem, but used for different combinations of notations. And in this context, it turns out that what it says is that D outgoing mode will be decoupled from the early radiation if the black hole's dynamics is scrambling. This means that you shouldn't be able to find a partner mode on R. Okay, so that is the conclusion. But anyway, let us think more about implication of this theorem. So this theorem just says that D and R are not entangled with each other. But because of the unitarity of U, this suggests that D must be entangled with C and A prime, where C is the remaining black hole degree of freedom, and A prime is the reference of the infolding observer. And one nice thing about this construction is that the non-locality problem is immediately avoided because we are not using any degree of freedom from the early radiation. That might be on the other side of the universe, right? So that's no problem at all. And because of this, our construction of the interior pattern operator is state independent, in a sense that it does not depend on the initial state of the black hole. But it turns out that because of this state independence, because we are not using R irradiation, nice thing is that the same expression of the interior pattern operator works well for pure state black hole as well. Now, this is very important because there is another version of the firewall puzzle due to Marov and Polchinski, which essentially says that, black holes, pure state black hole, typical state black hole, must have a firewall. And, but this construction actually resolves this version due to Marov and Polchinski. Now, I think it's important to mention that, at least to the best of my knowledge, proposals along the line of ER equals to EPR proposal do not offer a convincing argument to resolve the Marov-Polchinski version of the firewall puzzle. Okay, so we have state-independent interior operator, but it's important to keep in mind that I needed to use degree of freedom from A prime. This means that the construction is observer-dependent, in a sense that it just simply depends on the initial state of the observer. This seems to suggest that the black hole's interior is actually an observer-dependent notion. And if you think about this, then it's actually, there is an old work, it's again due to Hayden and Preskill, which essentially says that if two observers are separated by a scrambling time and jump into the black hole, then they are not able to meet inside the black hole. So it seems like this kind of scrambling phenomena actually creates observer-dependent black hole interior. So the idea is that because of the scrambling dynamics triggered by the infolding observer, unique interior mode generated dynamically. So here's a summary. Outgoing mode D would be entangled with R irradiation without introducing the infolding observer. But if someone actually tries to cross the horizon and then try to see the interior, then they will be immediately decoupled. And because of that, interior partner mode can be written in a state independent manner. And that expression works well for both young and old black hole. But it's important to keep in mind that this is something observer dependent. Now, with this construction, I guess the resolution of the firewall puzzle, at least the one due to Amp's thought experiment, is immediate. So in Amp's thought experiment, what we do is that first we are going to distill the qubit, in this case RD, that would be entangled with the D. And then we hand this RD qubit to Alice. Then Alice carries this RD qubit, and then she thinks that D and RD would be entangled. And she tries to cross the horizon. And then if she can cross the horizon safely, that means like D and D tilde are entangled with each other. So verifying the violation of the monogamy of entanglement. This is the thought experiment. But the resolution is that, D and RD are no longer entangled with each other, so there is no problem. And so this thing has a very nice gravitational interpretation by treating Alice herself as a source of back reaction. But I'm not going to go into details, but I think it's more important to give a bigger picture. So I have talked about Hayden-Preskill thought experiment, information loss puzzle, and also firewall puzzle, these two puzzles. And obviously, these are different puzzles, but they are related in a very interesting manner. In fact, if you run Hayden-Preskill thought experiment backwards in time, it becomes this firewall problem. To give you an idea, in Hayden-Preskill problem, you throw a diary into a black hole and then later catch Hawking radiation and try to reconstruct the diary. In the firewall problem, we have an outgoing mode and we want to find its partner. But let's think about this process backwards in time, then I'm just, you mentally think about it. You don't need a time machine to do that. Just mentally think about it. Then outgoing mode will be, of course, coming back to the black hole. So outgoing mode becomes an infalling matter, right? Then coming back, then at the beginning, we had the infalling observer. So infalling observer is sort of emitted from the black hole. So then by knowing the initial state of the infalling observer, we want to construct a partner of the outgoing mode. But this is, it's actually the same as the Hayden-Preskill problem. And it's actually, you can show the rigorous equivalence of these problems by using tensor diagrammatic techniques. But this is very nice because, yeah, these two are identical problems. And the nice thing about this is that we had the Hayden-Preskill recovery protocols. You can use these to actually reconstruct the interior partner mode in the firewall problem. So that's kind of the bonus. But because of this similarity of the problem, that this was the reason why we were able to use the same kind of theorem to resolve these two issues. Okay, so I have talked about four different things. But hopefully you saw that in these examples, the notion of the quantum error correction emerges naturally. And looks unrelated, but it seems like the underlying theme is the entanglement-assisted quantum error correction. But to see a more like universal feature of these phenomena, I think we need more work. But looking at the future, I think it's really important to going beyond ADS because our universe is not negatively curved. And especially there are essentially like, we should be able to formulate similar puzzles on the digital horizons and how do we resolve them. That's an interesting problem. And also I'm particularly interested in understanding how interactions emerges from quantum entanglement. This is, at least for now, it's within the context of ADS-CFT, but it will be interesting to do these calculations in actual holographic CFTs, because I believe that would be a kind of a check of the sub-ADS locality. And so, but also it's a dynamical check of the quantum error correcting nature of holography. Anyway, so that's it. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Benny. We're running a little bit late, but I'd like to start by asking if the students have any questions.
So to just go back to the very beginning, where you define like the five qubit code. It's very very simple, I think. So what's special about five? Because on the
my disappointing answer is it's not very special. It turns out that qubit has this five qubit code code, but I think it's more natural to construct this kind of models by using random codes, random encoding, like hard random tensors. And then if we increase the spin dimensions, then we can easily create such a code. And this version of the model has a property that is more similar to ADS-CFT correspondence.
Okay.
Any other questions? In the back?
Given your interest in out-of-time order correlators, have you looked at something like a Leggett-Garg inequality in this context?
So, what?
Have you looked at like a Leggett-Garg inequality in this context?
Leggett what?
Leggett-Garg is this statement about sums of correlators between three different times.
I see. Well, I didn't consider that, so I don't have anything to say, sorry.
Any other questions? Opening it up to anybody. Luis.
Yeah, Benny, at the risk of being burned on stakes, here because of the following. So you mentioned that in order to describe in the bulk interactions, you need to kind of resort to this entanglement assisted initial configuration of the field theory. Doesn't this maybe shake a little bit the belief on idea CFT in some sense?
Does it? it's more like, I think, if I have a normal ordinary CFT, like Ising CFT, for instance, then Ising CFT wouldn't give me the right resource entanglement, so I wouldn't be able to simulate such a scattering process. That's my guess. So that means like Ising CFT doesn't have geometry to make them scatter. So if holographic CFT does this, that means like at least this scattering channel is very well defined with some precision of the locality in the bulk. So in that sense, I think it's more like a good check of the candidate of the holographic CFTs.
But does it kind of select? So if I'm thinking the physics in the bulk, right, I can have any arbitrary set of interactions. Like our body is doing a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
The collection on the boundary, the socket on that collection on the boundary, the field theory describing the boundary is very special.
Right. So right now, I said that we should be able to interact in an arbitrary manner, but that itself may be a bit of overstatement. So I think the like concrete question in this context, more in holography, is that let's say like a bulk Lagrangian is free at the beginning, but I'm gonna add perturbations like higher order terms. And then that should induce like interactions, but then I should be able to modify the boundary Lagrangian, and then that should induce the interactions. And then in principle, if we can do that calculation on the boundary, then we should be able to see the interactions, but that calculation should be done in a way that is very special to holographic CFTs, utilizing secretly or directly entanglement.
Thank you.
I have a very easy question, I think. I hope that it makes sense. These CFTs, like, is the dimension something relevant? Everything that you've explained works for when you have, like, if you have a quantum mechanics in the boundary.
Right.
Like, does this work for any d-dimensional quantum field theory?
So everything I said about ADS CFT correspondence would work to the extent that ADS CFT correspondence works, and then that is D plus one dimensional and the D dimensional correspondence. Well, maybe there are a bit more fine prints, but roughly speaking, yes. And like information loss problem and so on, that exists in a system beyond ADS. So
you are in the meeting now.
To modify these ideas so that it is applicable to such systems. Yeah. So I in principle it should work in any dimensions, I guess.
How is your approach related to the islands and getting the base curve?
Sorry?
How is your approach related to islands and getting the base
curve? Right. So there are two things to say. So this tensor network, toy models, and so on itself is actually a kind of nice visualization of the how this page curve transition happens, because this tensor network automatically picks the minimal surface. So that's one thing. But for my result on information loss and so on, showing recoverability from scrambling and so on, that is a boundary proof of the recoverability, but this page curve is like a bulk proof. And then, yeah, it would be nice to connect these two calculations. They must be related in a nice way, but yeah, that's probably requires some more work, but
I think we may have lost the Zoom audience, but are there any questions online?
Yeah, I have a question. Yeah, we were disconnected, but we managed to connect again. So can you just
tell me how I should think of this cartoon, say, in more standard ADS CFT, like N equals 4. How should I? Because you have all these beautiful pictures with boxes and qubits, but then I'm used to N equals 4. I put 5 operators, I have usual CFT and usual string theory. What is the computation that settles some of these interpretations? Because otherwise you are saying some people think this, some people think that, and it looks like it's a never-ending debate. What is the computation I should do in N equals 4 to tell some of these things apart and to say this scenario is correct, this scenario is wrong? What is the? Can you formulate some of the things that you mentioned in N equals 4 language?
So everything I said is a toy model that follows from the entanglement wedge reconstruction. So it's a simplified toy model, but what is most essential point is the entanglement wedge reconstruction. Now, it's just a toy version of the entanglement wedge reconstruction. So the question is the entanglement wedge reconstruction is true or not? I think that's the key, most important technical thing which needs to be done. And as I said, there is an information theoretic proof that seems to suggest it is possible to write down, but we do not know how to write it down at this moment. And then there's this famous causal wedge reconstruction, which is smaller, for that we know how to do that. But going beyond the causal wedge reconstruction is, I think, a very important problem. And that should be eventually like addressed by using concrete CFT models. And then it's actually, this question is, I believe, related to this holographic scattering story, because holographic scattering, it's actually happening behind the sort of the causal wedge. Well, it depends on how you define the wedge, but it's at the center. So in that sense, understanding this dynamical problem is actually a key to even understand these entanglement wedge reconstruction. And then, of course, these qubit toy models are oversimplification of our universe, but ultimately, I don't see anything wrong about this simplification as long as the entanglement wedge reconstruction is true. But the entanglement wedge reconstruction itself is really needs to be more studied, I think. And
What is the computation that tells me in N equals 4 if this entanglement wedge reconstruction is true or false?
So let's say, well, pick operator on the bulk in the entanglement wedge and directly compute its effect on the bulk. And
but we don't know how to pick operator on the bulk.
Yeah, so I think that's why I feel like this holographic scattering might be actually a key, because it should be happening in the entanglement wedge in some sense, but I need to formulate it more carefully and precisely. But I have a sense that this kind of a dynamical problem is actually indeed related, because something going beyond the causal wedge, it's going to be more complicated. And I feel that some kind of entanglement should be used. And
By Juan and collaborators about this bulk point, about trying to detect bulk locality by studying boundary correlation functions.
Oh yeah, this is
scattering stuff beyond that. It's something else, or it's the same thing?
I think it has a similar spirit, but this holographic scattering problem, what essentially Alex is talking about, is, I think, much beyond, in a sense that in the original setup, I believe that we don't really need to invoke the importance of entanglement. At least it doesn't seem so. There is no causality issue in that setup, but in this particular setup Alex identified, we really need entanglement, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. So in that sense, it's along the same line, but it goes, I think, beyond. But I think you can say that it asks similar questions, question of similar nature.
Can I ask one more question?
No. We're 25 minutes over. I encourage you two to speak on Zoom or something. For the rest of us, we can speak with Benny downstairs. There are going to be some snacks. But let's thank Benny again for his talk.